On our convocation today, you know that Pastor Quill graduated from Concordia Seminary in 1980 and served for the first 5 years of his ministry in Connecticut. Since 1985, has been here in the St. Louis area as pastor at Reformation Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County. He's got a very intriguing topic to talk to us about, getting ready for the real world, adjustments, surprises, and challenges of the First Parish. I'm sure all of you students and all of us indeed are anxious to hear. Welcome, Pastor Quill.
Well, I'll admit the first part of that title was sort of given to me, wasn't it? And so then I had to find out what that meant. I kind of added the second part so I could talk. You usually do what you talk about what you want to talk about at these things and try to fit in. But I will talk about, try to make this practical, because that's what I was asked to do, the practical surprises. But I'm going to start with a reading from the scriptures anyway, because that's what pastors do, even the practical ones. From Numbers chapter 15, where the Lord speaks to the Israelites through Moses and commands them to wear tassels on the bottoms of their garments, blue with a blue thread in it. I thought this was intriguing. The Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they should make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put the tassel of each at each corner in the they should put on the tassel of each corner a cord or thread of blue, and it shall be a tassel for you to look at and to remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the harlot, in order that you may remember to do all the commandments of the Lord and be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God." Now, if we operate under the assumption that the tassel is just an extension of the hem, and that the significance of the hem was not just to stop the garment from unraveling, but rather a statement of the social status and of the person, kings, people of royalty having more extensive embroidering, fancier hems, tells us something significant about God's view of his people in the Old Testament, that they were to put blue in it. In Mesopotamia, some early Akkadian texts talk about cutting off the hem, and they refer to exorcists cutting off the hem and doing their spells over it. They refer to, in divorces, husbands cutting off the hem of the wife's garment. So remember David cutting off Saul's hem. There's got to be some significance there, possibly. No wonder he felt so badly about it after he did it. He wasn't just playing a little trick, but he was attacking the personage and the authority of God's anointed king. And in the case of his people, he told them to put a tassel with a little blue in it. If you think about it, nobody wore blue back then except for kings. The priests wore blue. The Holy of Holies veil had a blue thread. But the people wore it. I'm wondering whether you could see it or not, because it was just one cord or one thread. And that's sort of the fascination, I guess, about the whole thing. Whether you could see it or not, it was there. And what it said to those people is they were holy. They should act like it. They were God's people. They were priests. Maybe you'd have to look really close to see it, but that's usually the way it is. Even today, when you go to your first congregation, those people are priests. They wear a blue thread in their garment, and a lot of times it's going to take faith to believe it, the way some of them act. Now, I've never had any really serious problems with really ornery people, but you've all heard stories that there are some really ornery ones out there. There are a lot of people out there who sin, obviously, and holy priests aren't supposed to do that either. But nevertheless, approach your first church with the attitude that these people are priests. In fact, in Peter, he picks up on this in the New Testament. Peter calls the people, because of their baptism in chapter 1, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. In my first parish, there was a little guy who sat in the front row every week. And he just sat, a little Italian guy, and he slept. He didn't sleep. He just closed his eyes the minute the sermon started, crossed his arms like this. It was a little disconcerting because I worked really hard on those sermons. But it didn't take me long to find out that he listened to every word. He listened more intently than anyone else. And he could always tell me what I said. And one Sunday after everybody was gone, he came up to me and he said, "Pastor, that was a really good sermon. You're getting better all the time." Well, you all love to hear that. And I said, "Well, what was it?" He shouldn't ask the next question, though. "What was it about the sermon that you liked?" Well, what he said was something I didn't expect. None of the great theology. It was, you told the people how good they were. You told them how much you thought of them, how well they were behaving and displaying their Christian attitude. And I really didn't think that he would say that. It didn't cross my mind. I remember saying it, but I didn't think it was that big of a deal. But he reminded me that, and he takes sermons seriously. He listens that so often we prepare our text and we come across the law and we blast the people as if, and really sometimes the people we're supposed to be blasting aren't there anyway. And if we're going to blast them, well, at least let's remember the gospel as well. And we treat them as if they have a blue thread, which they do, even if you can't see it, and have a real high view of the people out there. I'm sure that you all by now know how to preach law and gospel correctly, and I'm not talking that we should just keep everybody happy with some positive thinking theology, but what I am saying is that as you articulate law and gospel, well, really I'm not talking about what's on the paper, because you can have a sermon written perfectly on law and gospel by one of your profs even, and then two students could preach it, and it could come out totally differently in each case because of the person preaching it. One's attitude might be law-centered and the other might be gospel-centered. If you really want to be Lutheran pastors, there's got to be something about your attitude in there that deserves the title evangelical, because that's really what we were called at first. We weren't called Lutherans. We weren't called something based on, after the law, but it was the gospel side that should... I'm just getting at an attitudinal thing here. And as I talk about adjustments and surprises and challenges, if you go in at the beginning just assuming these are a great bunch of people, that they're priests, that they're a holy nation, because that's the Bible's presupposition that you should have, you're going to have a really rewarding ministry. And the people will respond, and somewhere after about a year to 12 months, a mysterious thing happens. A bond forms. A bond forms between the people and the pastor. And I'm not talking about mushy-gushy stuff. I can't stand this touchy-feely malarkey, all this emotionalism stuff. If you just give them the solid word and sacrament stuff, there's going to be so much emotion. If you're into that, there'll be more emotion than you can handle if you love the people. And it's going to come. But there'll be something that happens there. And I usually find it happening at communion. That's where I first noticed it. In fact, now I've been at this parish 2 years. I first noticed it there. You just turn around and... all of a sudden, and some of these people are wonderful. The blue thread shows. Some of these people are ornery. Some of them, you even wonder if they're contrite enough to be up there, and yet you just say, "I love these people." It's marvelous. One other adjustment will be saying goodbye after 5 years at that church. That probably was the biggest trauma. You all experienced that. You've got to leave the church finally. Sometime, unless you die and you leave, then you don't have to have a farewell sermon. But like I said, I don't like this mushy gushy stuff. But boy, imagine getting up there and the guy in the back row, guy who in his spare time cuts down trees. I mean, he's no sissy. And he's sitting there with his three sons, and he's a convert from nothing. And he's got a handkerchief up, and he's bawling his eyes out. It's hard to keep control, and you realize that. If you treat the people like priests, boy, they're gonna give you all the strokes and esteem and the admiration and love that you ever would want. And I hope you're not going in this for it. I'm just saying it's going to be there. It gets kind of embarrassing at times. But I love it. And I think one adjustment that I have to make is to learn how to take compliments graciously. Because if people give you a compliment, they took the time to do it. And it gets embarrassing, but Even if they're complimenting you for the wrong things, it's still expression of love. So we owe them the same. Let me see. I know I've got more to talk about than I have time. Okay, I'll talk about adjustments, surprises. I grew up in a parsonage. I was a PK. I was also, as you were talking about, a missionary's kid. So a lot of the adjustments came by second nature. I didn't have to worry about them. My father was a missionary in Nigeria. I grew up with a real positive attitude towards the church and towards mission work, Christ-centered, positive evangelism type stuff. But certain things are not second nature to anybody. That's like not getting your way. You know, we like to get our way, especially when you put a lot of energy into it. And no matter how much you learn on vicarage or how much you learn at the seminary, you're not in the trenches until you're in the trenches, and to work your heart out and then not have anybody want to do what you want to do can be very heartbreaking. I usually got my way at my first church because I did my homework ahead of time. And if I thought I wasn't going to get my way, I didn't do it because I didn't want to be embarrassed. I never showed up at a voters' meeting or a council and threw something brand new at them, because if it was really worth something, you got to give them time to make a decision anyway. One member, the same little Italian guy, said, "Pastor, after about 3 or 4 years, Pastor, you have a rubber stamp council. Anything you want, they just stamp." What he didn't realize was that my ideas and my way was always their way. And I always checked it out with the people first. And if I had an idea, I got their input and it became their way. And it wasn't just the boards, but sometimes you got to look at the people who aren't on the boards. When you get there, you got to find out who's running the church. They may not even come to church. But you still better get them behind you. You're a fool not to. And if you just go in and you got these great ideas and if you're right, it doesn't mean anything if you just throw it at them. Because if you bomb out once, they'll forgive you. If you bomb out again and again, after a while, so I'm told, you lose your credibility. That hasn't happened to me, but I'm scared to death of that happening, because how can you be a leader if nobody's going to follow? I guess just the fear of that kind of keeps me very careful. So at least I thought I was in control. And until it came time to get a new pipe organ. And that was one I lost, and I lost big. It was time. The church needed it. My big, great vision for that church needed a good tracker pipe organ or a Zimmer or something. And when it came to the time for the voters, I did all my homework, did everything right. The voters came and they blew me out of the water. Hardly anybody wanted a pipe organ. They wanted a schmaltzy Allen electronic organ. You know, I haven't been giving them schmaltzy theology. What did they want a schmaltzy organ for? Because they were afraid. They were afraid it cost too much. And I told them that they could do it. We've done everything in the past. Trust me, I know what I'm doing. They didn't trust me. Well, actually, it had nothing to do with me. It had to do with their history. Their concerns of the past. Pastors come, pastors go, leave them with a bunch of... If I left, they're left with all this, then what are they going to do? But when they said no, oh, did I pout. I'm not a pouter. I pouted for 2 weeks. I'd never done that before. I was devastated. I could hardly get up and do the liturgy. You know, thinking I was doomed to have this one crummy organ replaced with another crummy organ. You know, beloved in the Lord. But I finally overcame that and took a call. Yeah. Actually, that's the point. I did take a call not too long after that. And of all the elements that went into the call, the pipe organ is not why I left. But I'll never convince a couple of people in that church that that's not why I left. And that's what troubles me to this day. That their value and their opinion of me went down a little bit. I mean, I'm not around. I don't have to face them, but they're still good friends. We still write. And I know in my heart, their value of me as a pastor, and I hope not the pastoral ministry, went down a little bit because I was a jerk. When we act unbecoming of a pastor because we get angry or we pout or we complain, if we don't watch it, It comes back to haunt you. In fact, after I was complaining, I went off from that pipe organ thing. I went off to a district convention and was complaining to a friend of mine, a pastor, and he said that you better not go back and complain too much because it'll come back to haunt you, and it does. That's a big blunder. I guess I consider adjustments and blunders the same thing, because if you blunder, then you got to make an adjustment. But quite often, it's the little things that drive you nuts, like a baby screaming. Did I hear baby? Oh, he's beautiful. Is it a little girl? Okay. Let me tell you this. Are you a pastor? That's your wife?
Canada.
That's what I meant. Canada, you bet. Oh, this. What? Close enough. Not quite close enough, but. Almost. I was in a sermon. I totally lost my train of thought. Everybody in the church was looking over this way at this screaming baby of this mother who had the baby out of wedlock. I mean, the whole thing was, the baby was even, and so it was right at my crucial point. You know, I didn't have that much gospel in there to begin with. And they're all looking over there, and I finally lost my train of thought. I didn't know what to say, and I said, "Would you get it out of here?" Well, couldn't I say, "Would you get the little lamb of Jesus out of here? You've run some fresh air. Get the precious little child. Take the little boy out. Get it out of here." And everybody noticed the lady walk out with a red face, but nobody noticed that the mother and the little baby had a little thread of blue in their garment. Now, the mother, what she did, she was the one in the wrong. Everybody knew that. But what her sin was just bad social etiquette. My sin was a crude, unforgivable sin against the royal priesthood. And I won't do that again. And you can let him scream all he wants. And that's an adjustment. It's the little things sometimes. The ladies' guilt. I'll give you some advice. The women's guilt. My attitude towards them is stay as far away as possible. This is practical stuff. You go to them just enough to let them know how great they are. Always tell them how wonderful they are. They're the backbone of the church. They're great. They're sending money to missions. They're making money. You know, all this stuff's great, but stay away as far as possible. But here's a situation where they didn't stay away from me. They got in my way. I showed up for one Sunday afternoon, evening late, I went by the church. This happened here, so please don't let this get anybody from. Yeah, there's a few people from my church. Don't let them know this. It's dangerous. I showed up to the fellowship hall where I have a Bible class. There's about 50 people in there. I've worked hard at that, started it from scratch. And you got to have continuity, and people got to be able to count on you being there, and the same thing. And all my tables were gone. No, they weren't gone. They were all messed up, all set full of dishes and stuff. I couldn't conduct a Bible class that way with flowers all over the place. The room just off to the side where the confirmation class was at was all full of crafts, so they could, this right after church, they were going to have a dinner to make money. You know, isn't that the purpose of the church, to make money? They were obviously totally messed up in their priorities. Word and sacrament at the hour, the holy hour, Sunday morning, what came second to making money. And so I just told the custodian, take this stuff off of there, get it out. You know, Jesus did that. Get it out of the temple. Kind of. Well, the rumor mill started going, and wasn't long and the phone started ringing, and all the ladies knew what I had done. And I didn't sleep at all that night. I mean, dumb things like that kept me awake all night. And I figured out exactly why they were wrong. And I went to church 6 o'clock the next morning, walked in, and they were already in there working in the kitchen. And I walked up to the ringleader, and I was going to give it to her. And she turned around and saw me. She was at the stove. And she said, well, first of all, she looked at me in anger. I looked back, and then she looked at me in fear. Really? You know, you wear your clerical and you're 6'2". You can intimidate any little old lady, and you don't have to say anything. And I walked up to her, and I put my arm around her, and I said, I'm sorry. I had no option. There's nothing else I could have done. I didn't want to do it. But advice from my wife and other people, I listened to it for a change. I said, "I'm sorry, would you forgive me?" And she said, "Oh, but we just didn't have time to set the tables up." "I know," I said. I'll see that our Bible class gets them all put up for you, okay? Will you forgive me?" Yeah, we gotta take it. Why didn't I think of that in the first place? But I just had to be in control and let these ladies know who was in charge. If I wouldn't have worried about that, it wouldn't have been a problem. And you can win, but if you don't win together, it doesn't mean anything. And I still don't like to say I'm sorry, but at least we got it. They're not going to do it again. I know they won't do that to me again, but if I talk about any more blunders, you're going to wonder why I was asked to be here. So I better change my direction here. Challenges. Preaching. Ask most pastors, what's the biggest challenge? It's the weariness of sermon preparation, and it's the most difficult when you're starting out and you're at a church all by yourself and you got to do everything. You know, for 5 years in a row, you preach it all, and if you go on vacation, you've got to write a sermon for an elder to preach or something. You don't even get out of it when you're gone. Depends upon the area you're in. Out where I was, at first there was a few pastors out there in the east I wouldn't let in my pulpit. I don't know what happened to me. By my fifth year, I let some of them in because I was tired of writing sermons. And it's like writing a term paper every week, except during Advent and Lent, you've got one every 3 days if you take a day off, and then somebody dies and you got a funeral. But if you work hard at it and keep them in your files, someday you take a call and it does help out at the next church. You'll rewrite them, of course, but it does help out. It's the bread and butter. Because if you do it, if you really work hard on it, it pays off. It pays off in your hospital calls. It pays off in your Bible class. It pays off in your evangelism calls. You're always fresh. You've always got it right up here ready to go. But if you think you're writing, if you're going to write your sermon out on the road, and think you're going to have something, it doesn't work that way. On the other hand, you don't just write the sermon in the office. You do all your gut, you know, all your hard work in the office, and then you go out on the... If you don't get out on the road, then your sermons aren't going to be good either. You kind of have to do both, and they complement each other so well. But it's a pain. It's wonderful. It's like, you know, lifting weights. It makes you stronger, makes your ministry stronger, but it's hard. What I've been working at is trying to develop a sense of liturgical awareness in my preaching. That's kind of a vague thing to explain. And how do you do it? You do it more just than by reading Luther Reed or something and figuring out what Epiphany and Advent means. I'm talking about a lot more than just that. And you do it by doing it. You do it by preaching the text and trying to figure out what in the world these texts have to do with the theme of the day. In the collect and the season, and you keep trying, you keep working at it, and little by little it starts to sink in, and over the long haul you really appreciate what we have. Imagine if you had to do the whole service and put all the, you didn't have what we have as a liturgical church. I remember back in the 60s when I was at DCE, the pastor said, "Let's come up with, you know, you did that, you know, let's come up with some new stuff." So we'd sit down at the table and come up with some new stuff. Boy, it was so, it's like water, not the living water. I mean, there was nothing there. It was so thin. What we have is so thick and has so much substance to it, you could totally blow it on a Sunday. And even when you're doing your job right preaching, you should be focused. Dave Mosman says when he preaches, he's the editor for Witness, says, tell him what I get one topic, one focus. I say, this is what I'm going to talk about. I talk about it, and then I say, this is what I said. And so even if you zero in on one thing, there's still all the rest of it there in the service for everyone. And it's practical. I want to give you some examples of why I think it's practical, just from my limited experience. And I'm sure you could come up with a lot more, especially some of your professors who understand this better than I do. It's practical from the standpoint that it can get you out of a bind. One of the big problems is I've been facing is people living in sin, not me. People living in sin in the congregation, these young folks, it's been driving me nuts. I've had more of a problem here in the moral heartland than I had out east. And but when I got out there, Oh, I've never preached a sermon on living in sin, okay? I mean, I don't do those things, pick those kind of topics. Once in a while, I will. In fact, I can only remember even referring to it in a sermon twice. It was in the text, and somehow I used it for an application. I remember the paragraph was about that long, one little thing, and it was at my first church out in New Hartford. I didn't even know who wasn't living in sin, but I just preached the sermon because I hadn't been there that long. And right afterwards, I found out that one of the pillars of the congregation, one of the leaders, his son, was living in sin, had a baby, and I'm sure glad I preached on it first, drawing that out of the text. Because if I didn't, it puts you in a bind. Somebody gets caught in something like that, and then you turn around and preach on it the next week. You don't, even though you want to. Because even if you say the right thing, they're not going to hear what you're saying. When I got here, I've heard a rasp of it. I don't have to tell you all the gory details. It's just that, I mean, sometimes the parents are worse than the kids. I've had a man leave the church because I expected his immoral child to at least move out and show some contrition before we considered marriage. Another gal almost left the church. She left for a while and she came back. And after wrestling through this, I was so glad last Sunday to have that text on the Samaritan woman. And I could let Jesus talk about it. And I didn't have to dwell on it. And none of these people can come to me and say, "Pastor, you picked that text just because of my son or my daughter." Everybody knows I didn't write the pericope. Everybody knows I just preach on what's there. And so it can be very practical and helpful in that sense. Another way it can be helpful is when you're hospital visits. What are you going to say when you get into the hospital? Sometimes things that have gone on in church just come to your mind. It's wonderful. A couple weeks ago, I walked into a room. The guy is suffering from a brain tumor, and he goes, "Pastor, pray for me." I said, "Okay. Pray that the Lord would come. Pray that he'd come now. Tell him to hurry up." And his wife's sitting there with her eyes wide open. And I said, "Do you want me to pray?" And she goes, "You would pray that the Lord would come for him real soon?" I said, "Well, we all do that, don't we, in Advent?" And so we just talked about Advent, and I got off the hook. He got what he wanted. She got what she wanted. Well, we all got what we needed about the various comings of Christ. Come quickly, Lord, come quickly. It was even more helpful last year during Advent when I had a man dying of cancer. And any of you who have looked somewhat on at people, you've studied the process of death. And when you get into that denial, I mean, you can play psychologist or something, or, you know, you learn this stuff. It's helpful. But I'm not that good at it, so I just learned this psychology stuff, and then I try to be a pastor. But it's helpful to be sensitive to what people are going through. You could see that the man, even though he was a solid Christian and his wife was too, they were going through that period where they had to come to grips with the fact that he was dying. How wonderful just to be able to take a bullet in the lawn with Advent. Every time I went, Advent intros and graduals printed in there. We should have the collect, but we didn't have that. I would use that too, the text. And in my ministry to them, I could just talk about what everybody else is talking about on Sunday morning. And then in a very natural way, they would start commenting on it like they do. And I could help them come to grips with this on their own terms. And it was a lot easier for me to do it that way too, because like I said, I'm just a pastor. I'm not some kind of doctor. Anyway, I was hoping he'd die in Advent. I was hoping the Lord would come for him in Advent, because then I'd have my funeral sermon already. But the Lord didn't come in Advent. He's probably trying to figure out what to do with Oral Roberts. but he didn't come, and he decided to come in Epiphany. And so, but it didn't matter, because by then he was in a hospice. He looked like somebody from Auschwitz. He was a steel worker. Guy was muscular. Now he looked like somebody from Auschwitz. And the darker things got, the lighter his light shines. What a living message for me. I don't think of him dying in January. I think of him dying in Epiphany and becoming one who shines through his life the light of Christ, manifests our Lord Jesus. So I had a funeral epiphany, funeral text. Any of you who, I'm sure you've all heard of Proclaim, right? Yes? No?
Yes.
I'm sure you're pushing it here. I didn't have Proclaim, which is a guide for planning liturgy and music, the first 5 years it's just coming out. I don't know how I lived without this thing. I sure wasted, and I didn't waste it because you always, it's not a waste of time studying the hymns. But when I didn't have time, I sure had a hard time coming up with meaningful hymns that would fit the whole flow and meaning of the service. I'd buy this, even if I were you, I'd buy it now, because you're going to have to be writing sermons now anyway. Especially if you got a rotten organist, because it tells you you can get a month ahead of time, and she needs to practice. And if you got a professional, a real good organist like I have now, you really want to give him a month ahead of time so she can pick all the other stuff to go along with it, the accompanying hymns, postludes and preludes and those kinds of things. Another challenge, balancing a commitment or a fervor for evangelism and a concern for thoughtful liturgical worship. Please don't buy this line that liturgical churches can't grow. It's wrong. Church growth is, you've learned, is multifaceted. There's a lot of things that go into sociology, population shifts. If everybody's leaving your community, I mean, all the schmaltz in the world is going to bring them into your doors. There's personality of the pastor, the personality of the congregation. Are they friendly? I mean, there's a lot of things. There's the theology. A liberal church which is just sold out on the particularity of the gospel is not going to have any mission emphasis anymore. The community that I was in grew by a sluggish 7%. I'm not saying this to impress you. I just want to prove a point. It grew by a sluggish 7% while I was there. All the other churches were declining in membership. The liberal high church, Episcopalian, and the low church, Congregational, and Methodist were declining. And the fundamentalists, they couldn't find a pastor that had their point of view. Only the Catholics kind of held their own, and we grew by 35%. And the community only grew by 7%. And we operated a church that was liturgical. We didn't give up on any of that. So it can be done. Now, what do I mean by that? What does it mean to be liturgical? I'm sure there are guys that would walk into my church and say, this guy's high church, and there are people that would walk into my church and I don't look high church at all. I don't, whatever that means. I mean, I don't consider myself that. You know, I chanted in chapel once. Well, you know, it's the first time I was here. Because Larry Rockerman asked me to chant. It was my first time when I was a student. And everybody assumed from then on I was high church. Now, I don't know if that's changed. But back when I was at the seminary, two years later, somebody out in the field came up to me and said, oh, you must be a friend. And he named some of the high church boys. He said, oh, you must be a friend of so-and-so. Well, I know him. He says, well, you chanted in chapel. So really, what does this mean? I don't want to encourage I do want to encourage those kind of guys to pursue what they're doing, but sometimes I think when you go way overboard and you lose touch with where the people are at, sometimes they're putting on as much of a show as... I don't want to get something of the wrong idea here, but they're putting on as much of a show as the Methodists, except at least the Methodists are trying to manipulate the people. These guys are just standing up there entertaining themselves. They may not realize it, and they may not intend to do that, but if they talk to the people, that's what a lot of the people are saying. And it's something I try to be aware of. My wife reminds me of that, because she's sitting out there with them. And the people remind me of that. So, on the other hand, I think there's a lot of guys that just stand out there and they think if they stand in the right place and read the words intelligently, at least they can be heard, that somehow that's liturgical. And then let's get to the sermon because that's what this is really all about or something. I've heard them say that. Oh, all the people are just trying to get to the liturgy so they can get to the sermon. Well, maybe they are. But maybe it's because of the way the liturgy has been done. I don't mean because you can't sing well enough. But maybe it's something that isn't inside. It isn't coming out. I'm talking now kind of, this is a weak part of my presentation because it's kind of hard to nail some of this stuff down. But I guess I'm trying to develop an understanding of what it means to have an appreciation of liturgical worship and be evangelistic at the same time. I don't think we have to sacrifice. I'm convinced we don't have to sacrifice it. I haven't, and we can grow, and we are growing. The church that I'm at now is growing. I think we've had a net gain of about 50 new members in the last, that's total in the last year, 18 months or so. And we've had to reverse a decline. We're working against the tide. But what I'm talking about is a way of acting when you get there that isn't just trying to put on some kind of show to save souls when they walk in the door. I'm not really concerned. I hope that anybody walks in the door and hear the gospel and get their soul saved. But how many people are there? I mean, we're talking about the majority of the people whose souls are saved and they came in the door and they're going to confront God. And what's the proper way to act when you're in the true, real presence of Almighty God? What's the real way to act when in sacramental worship? Well, I think the Lutheran liturgical worship enhances our view and understanding of God and of worship, and an understanding of the Catholic Church. Church Catholic, I mean. Not just all the other Christians and believers in the world today, but those that are already dead and in heaven. I think we have something awesome and big here that liturgical worship understands and appreciates. Like I said, I'm just beginning to understand it. And then people want us to start acting like Baptists? They want to replace the mystery of sacrament of baptism with a revival service? They want to replace the real presence and confronting God's very body and blood with sentimental music? And they don't even call it a sanctuary. I was corrected in the local Baptist church that they call it an auditorium. And I thought, well, okay. If you want to act like a Baptist, or you're tempted to, go ahead, but do it in the auditorium. I mean, even they would probably agree with that. But act like you're supposed to in a sanctuary. On the positive side, we do have narthexes, and I think most of our churches should act like Baptists in the narthex. It would help out a lot. We could call it a lobby, but... But we really, I'm not honest, I'm not afraid. I kind of like to blast the Methodist and the Baptist. That's the thing you do at a seminary. And I do. But I think we have a lot to learn from them. And one other thing, when you get out there, don't do what I'm doing with the people, please. It doesn't get you anywhere. It doesn't even get you a good laugh. It just gets people upset. I mean, after all, they were born and baptized in one of these churches. And half their relatives might be in these churches. And you don't win any points by being sarcastic and cynical and blasting these other people. You know what I'm talking about. But you can get away with it up here. And it's kind of fun. That's why you got to get together with fellow pastors once in a while, just to be rude. Well, I guess as far as the liturgy, I've got a couple pages here I'm going to skip telling you how to work at it. You can learn that here. Just work at it. Make it fun. But work at it. And be realistic. That's the only advice I'll tell you. You'll learn that. That's the adjustment. You got to be realistic. You're never going to be in the Hagia Sophia, and you're never going to be at the Crystal Cathedral, and you're going to have a liturgy that was developed in these big places, and you're stuck in some little church where a procession is a hop, skip, and a jump, and you're from one end to the other. You know, we had a processional cross, and, you know, and I had to tell them, really walk slowly. Otherwise, it wasn't procession. I mean, it can be rather silly if you're not aware of these things. And it might be a lousy organist. It might be a lousy organ. It might be a congregation that can't sing or can sing. So just take what the strengths are and really run with them and try to minimize that. You're going to have those weaknesses. They're not going to go away. So you just got to live with them and try not to let them frustrate you too much. Just try to minimize them the best you can. It's really easy to stand up here and to say this stuff. You know, when you have to prepare something to tell a bunch of guys who, see, I know it all. I've been out 7 years and you're sitting here. It's easy to say this stuff, but I don't know if I've really learned anything of what I'm saying, to tell you the truth. I really don't. But we owe it to our people to do the very best because they're the priests. They're holy. They're royal. One other item is balancing a fervor for evangelism. You want to reach out and bring people in. And you still want to be orthodox and in practice. And you all guys all know the way we're supposed to operate as Lutherans. Our traditions of communion policies, of unionism and all that stuff. Well, they sent me out to New England. And my predecessors, the three people there who were before me, had open communion, unionism. They had a joint service with everybody in town, including the lady at the Congregational Church, in Thanksgiving services. They had a joint VBS. Once it was held at our church, and a rabbi taught a course. Membership. Some of them didn't even have membership classes. One, there were a couple, I forgot where they came from, some reforming church. They just gave them a book to read. And another guy, an agnostic came in the door one Sunday to worship. He was related to a professor at Fort Wayne. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Not because of, I'm sorry, can you cut that out? And but he just kind of came to talk, and a good friend. But he happened to come in one Sunday before I was there, and they were having a voters meeting at the church, and they passed the book, let him sign the book, and he voted. Surprised they stayed in synod. But they did. I just crossed them out of the voters. The book when I got there, I didn't even take it to voters. I told them that that's what I did. You can get away with that a couple times. Lost my train of thought. So what do you do? I'm not going to go on how I handled anything, but you better pick your battles carefully. And if pastors who were legally, validly certified, trained, ordained, installed, and allowed to operate for 3 decades or however long it was at your church, I don't care how right you are, you're going to have it very difficult when you go in there if you think you can, just like that, change everything. I buried a pastor here in town not too long ago who was a member of our church, an old guy, who said when he went to Southern District, he had more Masons than who weren't Masons, and he told them that he was going to get rid of them all. 40 years later, he finally did. It took him 40 years. And he really promises them that. He said, eventually they're all going to be gone, but our church is going to grow, which it's never done. And it did. And you can be loyal to our principles. You don't have to buy all this nonsense about let them come in easily. I mean, all the other churches, I know why they got it. The other churches in town, if you walked in on a Sunday morning and you wanted to join, you joined. So that's, they figured they had to act like everybody else. All the other churches were declining. We grew by 35%. One thing I did had to get at right away, and the others I worked on slowly, was that Thanksgiving service. So I went to the elders, which never met up until that was their first meeting in years, and I got out all my little copies of the church Constitution Synod, and I let them read it themselves, and then I used this line. I heard somebody else use it before. My conscience doesn't allow me to do this. You know that one? How can you argue with your conscience? I never said they were wrong. I let them decide that. I just said, Synod, I signed this. I took a vow to uphold this, and it doesn't matter if it was scriptural. I took a vow to uphold the Constitution. That's sarcasm. I took a vow to uphold the Constitution, and I really couldn't keep my dignity if I did this. Oh, that's okay, Pastor. In fact, we're tired of this anyway. I mean, the services didn't mean much, but there were a few that it meant a lot to, who had relatives at those churches. This is a New England community where they go back generations. And having that service was a community thing that I don't think I appreciated and understood. And this one little lady, a couple times a year, Pastor, why can't we have those services anymore? Why did you stop that? So I would, how do you explain to an 80-year-old lady all the theology that's wrong with these other things? Or principles of fellowship. Well, you try. I know I did a lousy job, but I tried to do it as nicely as possible. She never did catch on. She always asked me that when I visited her. And one day she died, and her executress came by, and I found out I was left in her will for $2,000. I didn't know what to do. I went and told my wife, and you know what she said? She said, just think, if you would have been involved in those services, you'd have gotten $4,000. You know my wife. She's got a real sense of humor. But truth, jokes cover a lot of truth, though, I think. I think I got about 3 minutes. So I guess they don't try to correct it all overnight. I pulled this out of last week's Sunday's St. Louis Post Dispatch magazine. And I think it applies to the district. What do you do when you move into a district that may be, well, it doesn't matter what district you go to. How should you act at pastors' conferences and district conventions and those types of things, whether district or circuit? This was on the freshman senator, Jay Nixon. I don't know if any of you read that. This was one very interesting state off in Jefferson City. Freshman senators are assigned seats in the front of the chamber. Nobody wants to sit in the front. Look at that. Freshman senators are assigned seats in the front of the chamber and are not allowed to leave while in the crossfire of debate. So except for one short break, Nixon sat with his mouth shut, trying to look senatorial. Yeah, at least you can do that. Here's how you do that. You can do this as a pastor, too. As his colleagues trotted out one pet amendment after another and all of which faded in the home stretch, he rocked in his chair and placed his finger pensively across his lips. He flipped the pages of his handbook, doodled, buttoned and unbuttoned his jacket of his new blue pinstripe suit, scrutinized the end of his tie. This is the part I like. He practiced that penetrating squint set above a forward jut of the chin that masks a brain on dial tone. Isn't that good stuff? Don't you ever do that? You sit there thinking. You're thinking about a golf course. So often he cast a long glance toward the back of the room where the elder statesman roamed with impunity, passing notes, puffing cigars, and chit-chatting. A member of our church, very active member, is a congressman in Jefferson City, State Congressman Jack Goldman. And when he went there his first year, he rode up with the only other freshman, and he said in the first year, he's now in his second term, this other guy was one of these young guys that got up, and no matter what was the topic, he had something to say about it. Now, he was a Democrat, this guy got up. And he said, if he would have been a Republican, the Republicans would have quickly gone to him and said, please watch it. This isn't the way you act. The Democrats, he said, they act differently. They're patient. They let you go and make a fool out of yourself, and then they nail you. And that guy got nailed, and he's in the second term, and he's only now recovering. Well, we don't have these kinds of written rules in our church. But there are unwritten rules in churchmanship. I'd suggest when you go out there, especially if you're smart and you like to talk, just keep your mouth shut for a little while, because they'll let you know when they want to hear from you. And even if they're wrong, you don't have to, maybe I'm not saying the right thing, but there's a time to get up. You'll know when to talk. But just don't be one of these guys like, otherwise you're going to do more damage, and it's going to take you a long time for anybody to care what you have to say. And I guess the last thing I want to talk about is terror. Terror. I don't know if any of you ever feel terror going out. Some of you have been in businesses or in occupations, teaching other things, where certain things about getting up in front of people or making visits come somewhat second nature, and yet there are things that frighten you that you will have to do because you're called to do it. There's a guy named Wilson Harrell who wrote an article on entrepreneurial terror. He owns his own business. Am I out of time? Or a couple? This last thought. You know how they go. He owns his own business. A millionaire. He started from scratch. He was a pilot in World War II. Got shot down, and he was the Frenchman got to him, and to hide him from the Germans, they buried him in a cornfield and put a hole in his mouth. And he said he was there for 4 hours thinking about what could happen to him. That was terror. He said he thought, well, they could come by and kick over accidentally the hose, and he could drown in dirt. They could stick their bayonets in, or maybe they'd just start shooting down the thing. Or maybe they'd pour water down the thing. He said that was terror. And that went on. He had to get buried there 8 days. And he said, I figured I could always handle terror because I handled that. He said, but another thing he learned was exhilaration. Every day he was taken out of that hole. And he learned the exhilaration of being in a situation where you're totally out of control, but then it's okay. And that's exhilaration. And then he went into business, figuring he'd never experienced anything like that again, and he suddenly realized that in his line of work, and this is the president, the owner, the buck stops here kind of guy, and there's applications to us. We're not in a business. If we are in a business, we're in a business that is a lot more serious than just making a few or losing a few million bucks for your whole business. We're working for the Lord. And we may not be wheeling and dealing like that, but I mean, it's an awesome task for what we have to do. And there's times when you just feel with terror because the buck stops here. I don't care if you bickered, that doesn't mean anything, because if you blew it, you always had somebody to cover for you. You had a supervisor. And if you were alone, you always had a counselor, somebody looking over your shoulder. But when you're a pastor, if you mess up, you've got to fix it. And sometimes it can be frightening. He defined terror as being out of control and in a situation where you inflict. He didn't say like fear. Fear is where somebody runs into you or somebody aims a gun at you. He was saying the type of terror where you inflict it on yourself. You got yourself into this position. You chose to be in this company to start it. He says, and all of a sudden times come up where you can't control the future. And he said, and it's frightening. It's like being on a roller coaster. And for a month or two, your future's in somebody else's hands. Then it resolves itself, and it's exhilarating. And that's the pastoral ministry's like that, and getting into it, I'm sure. I know the first time I had to preach a sermon, I said, what am I doing here? When I got up that morning, I got in the shower, I felt depressed. You know, I was going to go preach the Word of God to people, and all I could think of was, who am I to take on this awesome responsibility? Or maybe it's the first Bible class. You know, that feeling's there every time I preach. I mean, I'm not terror-struck, but every time I preach, it's so awesome that I have that fright. There is one difference, though, and my dad reminded me of this when I was an acolyte. Now I'm going to close on this. My first time acolyting, I was scared stiff. You know, I looked like a little pastor, had my outfit on. I was with my dad, and you could see I was scared, but he always has this prayer before we go out, and he says, okay, let us pray. Lord, you got us into this, you get us out of it. That really calmed me down. I chuckled. And I've said that prayer a lot, but that's good. That's the call. You may have decided to come here. You may decide to allow them to call you, but finally the congregation will call you, and no matter how much terror you have, you're going to do it. You don't have any choice. That's how you cope with terror and fright. You just do it. You don't have to think, well, am I going to do it or not? And not only that, you've been ordained by God. You will be. And when you're ordained, he's saying, you're doing it. So it doesn't matter how depressed you are or how great you feel, you just do it. That's all. I don't know if that's a very good conclusion, but that's the conclusion of what I'm saying. I must have answered them all. See you guys. Yeah.